If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. In today's show, Seth interviews comedian Craig Ferguson and author George Saunders. Plus, as a podcast bonus, both of them answer a few more questions backstage at Studio AG. But first, a closer look.
After the failure of their health care bill, President Trump and congressional Republicans are trying to move forward with the rest of their agenda. Meanwhile, the bizarre story of Trump's false wiretapping claim only got weirder today. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. According to Gallup, on Tuesday, Trump's approval rating hit a record low 35%. And this is supposed to be the honeymoon period. And Trump should be good at those. He's had three of them. To give you some perspective, 35% is worse than Richard Nixon's approval rating during Watergate and George W. Bush's approval rating after Hurricane Katrina. In fact, even Bush seems taken aback by the chaos of the Trump era. New York Magazine reported yesterday that after Trump's inaugural address, Bush, who was in attendance, was overheard by multiple people saying, quote, that was some weird You know things are getting crazy when you can make George W. Bush sound like he's on shrooms. You know what's a funny word? Nuclear. And it seems like even many of Trump's own supporters may be getting tired of his antics, as CNN found when they interviewed 5 Trump voters in Pennsylvania on Monday.
Tonight, growing concern from President Trump's own supporters about his tweeting.
Nearly everyone in this group wants the president to stop tweeting about things like TV ratings at his inauguration and Arnold Schwarzenegger's departure from The Apprentice.
He needs to tone it down and forget about Snoop Dogg, forget about Arnold Schwarzenegger. We don't really care about them, do we?
I don't. If you want to be The Apprentice, step down, let somebody else run the country.
Do you trust the president?
In what vein?
And anytime you have to pause that long, the answer's not going to be good. Hey, before you operate, doctor, you went to medical school, right? I have been inside a medical school, yes. Now, of course, hanging over everything Trump does is the ongoing Russia investigation. In the House, the investigation is led by the Republican chairman and the Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, who has basically done everything he can to delay or interfere with his own investigation, raising the question of whether he's investigating Trump or working for Trump. And today, one of his fellow Republicans answered the question.
Are you concerned at all that he was viewing what he said was classified information at the White House, then reported it back to the White House?
Well, you got to keep in mind who he works for. He works for the president. He answers to the president.
Does he or does he work for the constituents of his district?
Well, you do both.
No, you don't. Congress does not work for the president. If Congress always did what the president told them to do, this guy would not have left office looking like this. It's not the look of a guy who had a bunch of help. Now, as you may recall, Nunes claimed to have seen evidence that Trump officials were legally surveilled, then went to the White House to brief Trump on that evidence. And today the story got weirder when the New York Times reported that the information Nunes saw might have come from the White House in the first place. writing that two White House officials helped give Nunes the intelligence reports. That means Nunes went to the White House to brief Trump on information he got from the White House. It's like when you send yourself an email reminder and 2 minutes later go, oh, a new email. Now, today, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked if Trump directed his team to find information to back up his false wiretapping claim, and Spicer tried to stammer his way through an answer.
Did the president direct anyone in this White House or in his national security team to try to find information or intelligence to back up his assertion about wiretapping?
I'm not aware of anything directly. I'd have to look into that in terms of, again, there's two sides of this. One is the information side, and two is the policy and the activities and the legal piece of what happened. And those are big buckets, if you will.
I mean, I'll bet Sean Spicer fantasizes about having an easier job, like Bill Cosby's publicist. Your question, there's a couple of buckets. Now, aside from the wiretapping story, Trump's approval rating has taken a major hit after he and the GOP failed on their central promise of the campaign to repeal and replace Obamacare. The Trump administration is trying to put the healthcare debacle behind them by moving forward aggressively on the rest of its agenda. So what's up next for Republicans after failing on healthcare? Apparently, their next big priority is letting internet companies buy and sell your private information.
Your personal internet browsing history up for grabs because of a brand new rule that lets companies sell your private information.
Congress just voted to repeal an FCC rule that required internet service providers to get your permission before collecting and selling your data. That includes things like your web browsing history, yes, and apps you use.
Should people expect that almost anything they put online is not private? I mean, that's sort of what it feels like to a lot of people now.
I think that's a realistic expectation. They should expect that everything they do is being tracked, from their location information to all the videos that they watch online, all of their internet traffic and browser history.
Okay, but just because you watched a video called What to Do If Your Son Eats a Lego doesn't mean that happened while your wife was out. And it was a false alarm. I ate the Lego. So apparently, this is how Republicans plan on bouncing back from their healthcare screw-up, by letting companies sell your private internet data. And if you find it hypocritical for so-called small government conservatives to support such a far-reaching measure, you're not alone. Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison made that point on the House floor on Tuesday.
It is beyond my comprehension that a conservative libertarian would say, oh, yeah, give the individual's information over to the big commercial interests. You guys have the House, you have the Senate, and you have the White House. The only restraint you have is yourselves. And I know there's got to be somebody in that body who believes that Comcast, Sprint, and all the rest should not have anybody's underwear size in this body.
But wait, why does Sprint want your underwear size? Hello, I'm calling to offer you an exciting new phone plan that includes unlimited calls for that big old booty. Now, the White House says Trump plans on signing this bill, although I feel like there's a pretty good chance he doesn't even know what's in it, given that he's not exactly our most tech-savvy president. In fact, according to friends, he doesn't even use email.
He's old school. He doesn't use email. Well, it means he doesn't use email, for example. For years, I've heard him say, I've seen businesses destroyed. I've seen marriages wrecked over email. You can never email Donald, and he will never email you.
I feel like even if you tried to teach Trump how to send an email, he would still just write it in Sharpie on the computer. And this send. Send. Now, if this bill sounds outrageous to you, you're not alone. But the question now is, will there be as much grassroots resistance to Trump's agenda going forward as there was to his health care bill? And so far, all signs point to yes. Take the issue of tax reform, for example. The next thing Trump and Republicans want to do is pass a major tax cut for corporations. But when South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham brought up the issue at a town hall over the weekend, he got an earful.
Now that the failure to replace Obamacare has died in the House, I think the next thing we'll do with taxes. Here's what I think is important, is to lower the corporate rate so we can be more competitive. Good, good. Come on, bring it on, bring it on.
Lindsey Graham's like a wrestling heel who is also a Southern gentleman. Bring it on. Bring it on. But just know, if y'all keep this up, Lindsey won't be giving out his homemade sweet tea and biscuits. So Trump couldn't get his health care bill passed. His White House seems to be meddling with the investigation into his team's alleged Russia ties. And he wants companies to be able to sell your browser history, all of which raises one simple question.
Do you trust the president?
In what vein?
This has been A Closer Look.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at iTunes.com/LateNightSeth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
Our guest tonight is a very funny comedian. You know from his time at The Late Late Show, he hosts The Craig Ferguson Show, which airs weekdays on SiriusXM's Comedy Great channel. Please welcome back to the show our friend Craig Ferguson, everybody.
Oh, this is so nice to be here.
It's great having
it's
you
It's really
back.
Nice to be here and see how Late Night's progressed, and it's all coming along great. And can I just say, Fred, it's so good to see you.
Hi.
I don't know if I entirely agree with your analysis on March Madness, but that's not what I'm worried about. I'm worried about the size of your microphone. You see the size of that? It seems a little stubby. You see it? I think they're shortchanging you. The microphones used to be longer. That's like a little amputee microphone.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. That's Fred Armisen. That's not just anybody.
Do you know what I think is so great? That you, Seth, you are not known for impersonations. That's not your thing.
You're no.
But you've been doing Trump so much, you do a really good Trump
now. Thank
you.
Yeah.
Really good.
Turns out, if I just picked any person and done them every day for 500 days, I would learn.
Like, if I was still doing late night, Trump would have to sound like Sean Connery, or I'd be ruined.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask about this, because I've heard you say that is the one thing that you lament is you don't have your late night show in the Trump era. Do you think it would still be exciting to be doing it?
Well, I lamented it when I heard he was running.
Right.
Like, when I heard Trump's going to run, I'm like, oh, come on!
Yeah.
But then, after a couple of months, I'm like, yeah. Oh, no, thanks a lot. I mean, because you have to deal with that every night.
Oh, yeah, it wears you out.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could do it. I really don't, because you have to, but, Like, and everybody, I'm now angry at people I agree with. Like, they say things I agree with, and I go, oh, shut up! That's how I talk all the time.
I feel that, it's very common to be at dinner with people where someone will just say, let's just not. Let's just not talk about it.
Yes, that's right. Everybody's trying to behave like it's Thanksgiving dinner. It's like, for 2 hours, we're going to behave like a normal family.
Yeah.
Right. That's the way it is, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do right now. Like, on the radio show, I try not to talk about it. But, of course, we end up talking about it.
I want to talk about your radio show. I did it last week. It was a delight.
You were amazing.
Oh, stop.
Oh, no, amazing.
Don't oversell it.
Look, I'm not gay, but I wanted to have sex with you.
Thank you.
You were amazing.
I got that.
I did want
I was getting...
And I know, like, you're happily married, and I'm happily married, and you're not gay, and I'm not gay, but I was thinking, let's start a tickle fight and see where it goes.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because... We did it here in New York. This was an away game for you because
you do your show. Usually I do the show in my... I wasn't going to do a daily show again. But my wife was like, you should really get out the house. And I said, well, I don't want to go and do all that. But Sirius said that they would put a radio studio in the shed at the bottom of my garden. So that's what I do. It's a 15-second commute to work, naked.
Wow.
Walking.
But you still have guests, so you can't be fully naked.
Oh, okay, I guess. I guess, Mr. TV, I wear pants to every single show. No, I mean, I wear sweatpants if Larry King's on or something. But other than that, no.
For the A-listers like Larry King.
Yeah, if you get an A-lister, you're like, oh, hey, how you doing? It's good to do. I think it's good. It relaxes the guests when they see my nipples.
There you go.
And they see, although, because when you look at me now, you think, that is a man in amazing shape, but you're wrong. I've got little pockets of fat here and there. Just little pockets.
And over the course of the interview, they can find them all.
They move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. It's a Scottish thing. They travel around.
Oh, interesting.
Mm.
Do you...
Does that excite you? A little bit.
Now, moving pockets of fat, does that excite me? Do you have callers on your show?
Yeah, we this is the thing about doing the show live, which, of course, this is, too, but the... But it's actually live, so you can say to people, call us. I always get the number wrong and say 1-800-MATTRESS, but some people do call. And a lot of them are truckers because it's drive time.
Right.
And I'm kind of surprised that the high... I don't know what the actual numbers are for transgender people in the, you know, in the community at large, but amongst truckers, it seems to be very high.
Really?
Yeah, we're getting a lot of transgender truckers calling in, and which I'm delighted to
buy. Yeah, that must be a fascinating slice of the populace to talk to.
Well, it certainly has moved the dial for me in the terms of, you know, my preconceived notions of truckers. I did not expect them to have a large, welcoming area of transgender life, but they do.
Well, that's fantastic.
I know!
These are the things you find out.
I know!
We talked the other day. I can't remember what day of the week it was. Wednesday, Thursday, something like that.
Yeah, it's a blur to me.
And then afterwards, you were very excited because you were going to a hockey game. It did not strike me that you were a huge... Are you a huge hockey fan?
I love the sports the way Fred does.
Okay,
I can't
gotcha.
Get enough.
Okay.
I can't get enough.
And you... But you... As a lover of sports, you should have known that Madison Square Garden would cut to you at some point during the game.
I didn't think that much of myself.
Because they
but
did
there
cut
you are.
To you, and that's not the most flattering.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I was smelling my finger.
Oh, there you go.
I don't know. Yeah, come on.
Okay.
All right, you see?
Yeah.
Kind of pineapple-y.
Yeah, it's all
right. I know. It's nice. Do you enjoy the sports?
I do enjoy the sports. I like going
to Madison Square Garden.
I do go to Madison Square Garden. I actually feel like, because sometimes they'll like cut to you, like they'll go around to people who are recognizable.
I know.
And they stay on you too long.
Yes.
The camera stays on you for a full 8 seconds, and you just sort of have to go like. It's awful.
That's how I did my late night show. I'm fine with that.
That's it. You would never. You weren't gonna blink. You're like, keep it here all game.
Do you know what's weird though? When you do a radio show and that stuff happens, you can't go anywhere. Like like nothing's being said, and you're just like, people get weird.
I want to ask about this because obviously you're Scottish and Scotland.
Really?
Scotland has this relationship with Donald Trump because
he doesn't seem to care for him very much. I will say that.
He owns, even before this thing, he owns a lot of...
Well, actually, I was a member of a golf club because I like to play the golf every now and again. Uh-huh. Just, you know, once every now and again.
Right,
one hole,
to maintain your
one
citizenship.
Hole,
Scottish.
Maybe every 2 or 3 years.
Okay, got it.
And I was a member of this golf club, and then Trump bought this golf club. And now I don't know what to do because I'm like, one part of me is like, well, that's it. And another part of me, well, it's a pretty good golf club.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm torn.
When did you know he was going to win?
The very first debate.
Okay.
Very first debate. When I saw him with Jeb Bush. Because remember Jeb Bush?
Yeah, barely.
Those were innocent times, weren't they? No, Jeb, in that debate, remember in the debate where Jeb Bush said, hey, you said something naughty about Mexicans. Now, apologize to my wife because she's Mexican. And Trump went, nope. And I was like, Jeb, you have painted yourself into a corner. You know, you said to a man, apologize to my wife. That man said, no, now you have to hit him. That is in the Constitution.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And then I knew Trump was going to win.
Wow.
No self-doubt. None.
And none even now.
Nope. Yeah. He's got people all over the world calling him names. People here, people abroad, people like you every night. And he's like, I am awesome.
Yeah.
I really actually admire that. I want to have
What I wouldn't give.
Yeah, I'd be like, can you imagine like the amount of sleep you get at night? Well, I was awesome again today. Good night, everybody. Awesome.
Well, something for us both to aspire to. Thank you so much for being here.
Always a
delight to see you. Craig Ferguson, everybody. The Craig Ferguson Show airs weekdays on SiriusXM's Comedy Great Show.
Hey everybody, this is Henry. I'm here with Craig Ferguson.
Hey everybody, this is Craig Ferguson. I'm here with Henry.
That's right. You hosted a talk show for many, many years. I'm wondering what it's like to go on talk shows for you.
It's very nice, actually. I was just talking to Seth about it after the segment finished. It's lovely to visit because it's like visiting an old friend or going to see family, and you don't stay long enough to get bored with them. You just stay and say hi. It's great to see you. Wow, you look great. Did you have your tits done? And then you leave, and it's really nice.
Yeah. Well, you interviewed people on that show. You've got a new serious show where you're interviewing people.
Yeah.
Do they blend together? Do you forget who's been on, who hasn't been on?
No, yeah, because I haven't been doing the radio one that long, but it might happen like that. I think on the radio show, you talk to them longer.
Uh-huh.
So they they register a little more, I think. And, you know, in late night, it's like 8-10 minutes, boom, 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 next. So they don't kind of land the same way.
Right. How did your job as a late night host change over the years? How did you feel yourself kind of getting into the role of it? Well, and now switching to radio, too. How did your role kind of change?
Well,
these
I think more and more, I kind of a casual disregard for preparation and a certain looseness, I think, to be honest, that you just kind of don't worry about it so much. It's right. Like there'll be another one tomorrow, and I'll do my best, and just listen to what they're saying, and, you know, and... Not with no disrespect at all, not allowing yourself to be overproduced. Just saying, okay, this is just people talking. It's not rocket science. It's fine.
Absolutely. Well, you did a great job. And it was so fun to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
I'll come here anytime you want, twice a year.
Great. We'll get something in the books.
All right.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Our next guest is a multi-award-winning, best-selling author. His highly anticipated debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, is in stores now. Please welcome to the show the great George Saunders. So wonderful to see you again.
Nice to be here.
So this is, we've talked about this before. Everybody knows who Lincoln is. But the Bardo is a term that people aren't familiar about.
Right.
Or with, I should say.
Yeah. It's a Tibetan term that just basically means transitional zone. So in the book, it refers to that zone that starts the minute you die, and it goes to whatever happens next.
And this is, you based this on a story you heard about when Lincoln's son died, very young. Lincoln visited him in the crypt twice in a night.
Yeah, that was in the newspapers at the time that he'd been so heartbroken that he went there several times to hold the body.
And so you decided, this was years ago you heard this story, and you decided to write your first novel about this.
Yeah.
And there aren't a lot of characters, really, in that story. There's just one grieving father and a dead body. Yeah. And so explain to us how you filled this out with characters.
Right. Well, I mean, in art, you know, one of the things that helps you is when you get a problem like that. Like, so you got Lincoln in the graveyard at night. Who's the narrator? It could be Lincoln. But then you're like, 4 score and 7 minutes ago, I did come into yon graveyard, and, you know. Or it could be like a, you know, like a gravedigger. Who's staying late or something? You know, like what? Like,
yeah.
I'm just practicing. You know, I do. So, what often happens is when you run into a problem like that, it really is an opportunity. So for me, it was like, well, who's in a graveyard at night? Well, a ghost, you know. So I kind of stumbled on this idea of a kind of Greek chorus of these kind of unhappy spirits who are stuck there. Mostly they don't know they're dead. Something happened in their life that made it impossible for them to sort of go on peacefully. Yeah.
And I always think it's important when I tell people about this book because, you know, the pitch is very sad. This is a story about a grieving Abraham Lincoln. But you created all these ghosts, and they're very comic characters. Is that when you went into it? I know your style is often to bring humor into things. Did you think when you first heard that story about Lincoln, did you think, there's going to be some laughs in there?
No, I did not think that. It's actually, in a way, I think making a book is a bit like riding a bike. You know, you front-load a story with that much sadness, and at some point it just gets unbearable, and you look around for something else to do. So you're kind of, you know, the reader is in, like, an intimate communication with you. She's looking at you, and she's like, dude, your story is too sad. You know, you're harshing my buzz here. So then you say, all right, I know. And it's in that moment of saying, I know, that you can correct. So you've got your eye on the reader. You're thinking very highly of her. And when you start getting tired of the sadness, she is too, then you just put your finger on the scale a little bit and lighten it up a bit, you know?
You talk about, I've heard you say this a lot, the common architecture between the writer and the reader and how you were making this connection. And sometimes, you know, obviously I read this book and now I can talk about it with you, but some people connect with writers that have been dead for hundreds of years, and yet they found that common architecture. Is that just, are you constantly listening for that reader and thinking, oh, I hope that what I'm writing here is true enough to the human condition that it will resonate in 100 years?
I think what I do is I kind of imagine, well, two things. One, I'm writing for me if I hadn't already read it a million times, so would I still be in it? Would I still be moved by it? The other thing you're kind of doing is you're always trying to elevate the reader in your mind. So in other words, the first draft is often the character's down here, and you and the reader are scoffing down at him. So you're disrespecting the character, but you're also kind of disrespecting the reader in a way. You know, you're saying you won't mind being kind of condescending to this character. So I see the revision process as I'm trying to bring the character up in my mind, so I like him better, so I love him more. And then when you see me doing that, you come in a little a little too. So in the ideal case, it's kind of a sort of three-way respect fest where we're all kind of manifesting our best selves in a certain way. You know?
Well, the example you used, if you don't mind doing it for us, is that Bob, you basically had the sentence, like, Bob was an ass
right.
to a
right.
barista.
Yeah. So, I mean, often in a first draft, you just throw something down, and usually the character's a little. So you start off with just, Bob was an ass. All right. I mean, there are such people in the world, you know. So then the god of fiction kind of goes, how so? You know, what, yeah. And so then you say, all right. Bob was an ass because he snapped at the young barista. And the god of fiction goes, oh, okay. Why do you think he did that? And again, you just supply quickly. Bob snapped at the barista who reminded him of his wife, his dead wife. And suddenly, just with a few little moves, he's gone from an ass to a guy who loved his wife so dearly that when she died, he couldn't even function well enough to be nice to a young person. So that's what I mean. Now, suddenly, Bob has come up in my mind. You saw me elevate Bob, and you think better of me. So suddenly, we're in this kind of little troika of mutual respect. It's quite pleasurable.
It's very nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
Right. And all I'm doing is reading it, and yet you've made me feel better about myself.
Right.
So thank you.
I did
the least amount of work. I didn't have to write it. I didn't have to be an asshole to a barista. So you talk a lot about revising and the importance of a writer revising. Talk about the example of just, and again, to make you use your own example, of how Jane walked into a room and sat on the couch and how you can take that down.
So the thing is, when you're on the reading end of a book, I give you a sentence. You kind of know what I think of you by what that sentence is. So let's say I start off rather sloppily with Jane walked into a room and sat down on the brown couch. It's a perfectly workable English sentence. But somehow when you hear that, you kind of feel like, yeah, all right, you know. So what I can do to show you respect is start to trim the crap out of that sentence. So, for example, is it necessary for Jane to come into the room if she's going to sit on the couch? No, it's totally implied. So you cut that. Jane sat down on the brown couch. Okay, better. Could she sit up on the brown couch? Not really. Cut that. Then you got Jane sat on the brown couch, kind of getting into like Hemingway land, you know. Then you say, okay, well, why does the couch have to be brown? That's not meaningful. Cut it. Jane sat on the couch. And then if you're like me and I have this really active inner nun, you're kind of like, why is it meaningful that she sits on a friggin' couch? So you cut that. And you just have Jane.
You know, right. And then you go to work.
But you don't suck yet.
Yeah.
You
know,
but that is a way of conveying respect. You're saying to the reader, I know you're as smart as I am, as worldly, as experienced, as good-hearted, so I'm not going to waste your time with phrases that haven't been considered, basically.
Yeah. Well, I've never read one of yours that didn't seem considered. Thank you for this fantastic book and everything that came before it.
Thank you.
It's so heartbreaking. It's so funny. It's always such a pleasure to see you. George Saunders, everybody. Lincoln and DeBardo is in stores now.
Everybody, this is Henry. I'm a producer at Late Night. I'm here with the great George Saunders. So George, people are very excited because you're known as primarily a short story writer. This is your first novel. But if you open the book and read the book, it clearly doesn't look like a novel. It's dialogue, historical references, monologue. How did it end up in that specific form?
Yeah, you know, I heard somebody say once that a novel is a long work of prose that has something wrong with it. You know, and so by that standard, it's a novel. It just really, you know, I think it's kind of like banality avoidance. You know, you start with an idea for a story, and there's kind of a first-order approach that you'd be inclined to use. So in this case, it was kind of like a third-person Gore Vidal-ish kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it just didn't interest me somehow. I just get started on it and kind of dread going back to work, and there weren't any sparks, you know. So at that point, you start kind of just shifting in your seat a little bit and trying to find some other way to get at it. And in this case, I had many years ago written a book kind of similar in form that didn't actually work, but the form was kind of fun. So it kind of presented itself, and as soon as I thought of it, I had that most coveted feeling, which was like, fuck yeah, this is what, you know, just a sense of excitement, which also has usually a little bit of a quality of bafflement, like, how is that going to work, you know? Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've learned that mood is the best one to write from, where the form is weird, you don't really know how to do it, it's like a car you don't know how to start, and it seems intelligently situated to solve a real problem. Then you're like, okay, I don't know where this is going, but wherever it is, it's not going to be empty. It won't be, it'll be fun, and it'll be to purpose, you know.
So when you were younger, you've said
before that you tried to kind of imitate other writers like Raymond Carver and Hemingway. You teach now at Syracuse. You must have students coming up to you and saying, I'm trying to imitate you. I'm trying to write in your kind of voice. What do you say to them, and what do you kind of think about imitation?
The funny thing is, when they come to Syracuse, after they get to know me a couple weeks, they stop doing that imitation. I don't know what that means. But no, there's definitely, I've heard of that, and I've seen some things. And really, I think it's just totally appropriate and holy that if a young person is fired up about language, the first thing they would do is they'd go and imitate the writer that moved them. I did it. Everyone does it. The trick is, how do you burn through that tendency quickly? And for me, it was kind of like, I loved Hemingway so much. He was the guy that I really loved. And so, of course, you do that thing where you're kind of telling your life in his voice. And so it's like there's a mountain over there called Hemingway Mountain, and you see Ernest up there, and you're like, Ernest, I'm coming to you, you know, and you kind of go up there. And when you get there, you find out that he's up there, you know, but he's on a little pedestal, like 8 inches high, that's shaped exactly like his feet. So he doesn't really watch up there. And the best you can do is you're going to come up to his armpit, you know. And what that means really is that you get that kind of yucky feeling that you have some valid experiences that express in his voice lose their validity.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a sickening feeling. You're like betraying your own stuff. So then you trudge down. Never again, that fucking guy. I'm never gonna. Why would I imitate that guy? His dad was a doctor. He's a rich kid, you know. And then if you're me, you look over and you see Kerouac Mountain. Mm-hmm. Now there's a working class guy. So you go up there and you spend a few years up there. And same deal though. So for me, that correlated with a period in my life where I was maybe 30, you know, and had kids. I had some real suffering that I'd gone through, real trials and stuff like that. And I felt like I knew a little handful of things that, because of this imitation thing, weren't finding their way into my stories.
Yeah.
So that was kind of bitter, you know. And so at that point, I wrote a little story that was quite minor, but it was really different. It was, it's in the first book. And you kind of come away from that like, wow, I really did something in my own voice that's kind of minor. And so it's like you look over and there's a little shit pile, you know, and it's got a sign and it says Saunders.
That's you.
But at least it's you, you know. Yeah, and so you go over and you stand on the shit pile and you're kind of sad and kind of happy. You know, you're sad that that work isn't as significant as that of your heroes. Sure. But you're also kind of happy because at least it's yours. And you stand there just hoping that the hill will get bigger over the years, basically.
Last thing I wanted to ask you, before you were at Syracuse, you got a degree in geophysics from the Colorado School of Mining?
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us how you moved from that to the George Saunders we know today.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to go to college, and a couple of high school teachers intervened on my behalf and got me into that school. So there was no way I was going to flunk. Got a degree in geophysics, went to work in Asia. And I never was that good at engineering. I could do it, but I didn't have a love for it. But I liked to read, and I was starting to write a little bit, just a little. So I had been out there in Asia for about a year and a half, and reading all the time, and kind of thinking, yeah, I really want to be a writer. And then I went, I was on my way home, and there was a little town called Nilo. It was right on this river, and there was some drinking, and I thought it would be so romantic to swim in the Sumatran River in the moonlight, naked, you know. So I jump in, I had a bunch of beers, and I'm out there in the middle of the thing feeling really happy, and I look up and there's a pipeline, like an oil pipeline, running right along the river, and like 300 monkeys just looking at me, shitting down into the water. And I remember thinking, God, I wonder if this is okay, you know, and it wasn't. And I got sick for about 2 years, like this kind of weird infection that the Asian doctors couldn't find it and the American doctors had never seen it. So it was like, honestly, it was like being an 80-year-old man for a year and a half. Like I'd have to get 14 hours of sleep. And so I quit the job and came home, and then I just was like, well, every day that passes, I'm eroding my engineering degree, and I don't want to do that shit anyway. I really want to be a writer, you know. So that was kind of the transition. And then from there, it was kind of just a series of blunders. And then one day I was at this wild party in Texas, and I read a People magazine on an end table, and it said that there was that Raymond Carver taught at Syracuse, and I didn't even know there was such a thing as an MFA. So I applied and got in, and then everything kind of switched from there.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So all of us who love your work have shitting monkeys to thank.
Yes, I've written a lot of thank you notes to those monkeys. I don't know if they got there or not. But
thank you again for being here. Such a pleasure.
Thank you. What a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Awesome.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.